Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will Tom Main contribute to Dallas's ever-growing collection of world-class public architecture? In recent years, Main's firm Morphosis has produced the innovative Caltrans building in Los Angeles, the United States Courthouse in Eugene, Oregon, and the 18-story Federal Building in San Francisco, which features an ever-changing facade that allows the interior to remain comfortable even with no air conditioning system above the fifth floor. In 2005, Main crowned his long list of awards with the world's highest honor for architects, the Pritzker Prize, whose other recipients include Philip Johnson, I.M. Pei, and Renzo Piano. Earlier this year, he was chosen to design the Museum of Nature and Science, which is planned for Victory Park in Dallas. He's in town for an address tonight to the Nasher Salon Series, and we are delighted that he would make time for us. Tom, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hello.
How does design affect the culture of a city?
Boy, big question. Mm-hmm. Well, design. I guess you start with what a city is. A city is a collection of who we are in a way, isn't it? It concretizes our ideas. Buildings are they reflect our values, and they shape behavior, and they become they operate as symbol systems, and they represent who we think we are as a culture. They affect our children, and radically shape their behavior of how they interact in the world. They're also about design. I didn't touch that yet. They look like something, and they have stylistic preferences, which are the result of these processes. That'd be maybe the conversation that I think most people see design or architecture as within stylistic terms. And I think an architect is going to see it as the result of a series of processes, and they're going to be directly connected to the forces of our work, economic, political, cultural, social, ecological, because it deals with huge amount of kind of territory, kind of what makes up what we call architecture today. And then, of course, cities are nothing more than the accretional. They're one house and then two houses and another building, and it builds up from village to town to city to metropolis, and it happens incrementally, kind of a thing at a time.
But working now in a city, you drop a building into something that's already built very much, and you have to take all of that into account, whether you like what's there already or not.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't really allow myself to think about whether I like it or not.
Really?
I have my opinions, but it's funny. I've learned to become somehow more neutral. I mean, this could be a long conversation about Dallas, or whether I like Dallas, or don't like Dallas, or what Dallas represents as a city. But what I find most interesting is that you find a found site, and I'm working in the middle of Manhattan. I'm working in La Défense in Paris. I'm working in Shanghai, and on is really not forming your opinion whether you like it or not, which is a separate discussion, but deciding what are the components about that place that contribute to your particular invention. To your to the generation of the piece of work you're looking at, and how it contributes or challenges to that situation, and then after that, I guess, is a discussion. Yes, Paris is a great place. Happen to like London, and New York is the center of the universe, and on, and you can talk about it in more personal terms. But it's I think in the beginning, it's the connection of the urban environment, of the environment itself, and the piece of work, and where that directs you, where that takes you.
So do you think about your work as existing in the time for which it is built, or do you imagine some of the things that you design are going to serve their purpose for a few decades and they might be replaced or renovated or changed? Or do you create a piece of work thinking, I want to make something that could be standing 1,000 years from now?
Well, that's what every architect used to always want to do. Build something transcendent. It's looking back. It's Rome, or it's Florence, or wherever you want to go. I think today it's a little more difficult, and that the largest thing that took place in the 20th century in terms of change was the change itself, and then the rapid acceleration of being able to anticipate where we're going to be. Forget a century from now, a decade from now. And I think because of that, I think that we're much more concerned as architects in the present, but clearly looking at some anticipation of durability or the lasting nature of our work, especially when they're dealing with institutions. So this is the Nature and Science Museum, that it's certainly in your head that you're considering the nature of the of this enterprise, certainly within a couple of decades, let's say. I thought you were going to go someplace else because we're working in the present. And I think there's so much taking place in the present that it asks questions or it challenges you even in trying to anticipate the future, because as I said, one of the issues taking place today is under just getting our arms around the present. It's such a complicated world we live in.
Plus technology is coming.
But the challenge is coming maybe a decade down the road, certainly not a century. And there isn't too much room for the past. That it's always been a mystery to me of why, especially in this country, there's so many new modern buildings that look like old buildings. And what's so interesting about building buildings that belong to some past?
People say that's an homage to the past, to what was great in the past.
But there's so much taking place in the present. We live in one of the most exciting, I can't imagine a more exciting time in history. I mean, the 20th century it's the next renaissance. It was the time we really redefined. It was the paradigm shift. And whether we're in the sciences, whether we're in the arts, no matter where you go, we're looking at this absolute radical shift of how we understand each other and how we understand each other within the global context. And the beginning of the 21st, of course, I'm saying this also in context as the architectural team now that's working on the Nature and Science Museum, we're looking at an explosion of how we understand our personal engagement with the world within macro terms, that we can understand how our very simple behavior, driving an automobile, eating a certain type of food, connects to broad macro environmental global issues, which is a kind of phenomenal, isn't it? And you could look at, again, I would think an average 9-year-old today has this huge kind of information available and useful to him or her, and has an understanding of their place in the world, their little town within this large globe we call the world, that's completely, totally different than what would have taken place even 30 years ago, let's say. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, even in addition to having the challenges of having to imagine what's coming ahead and what you need to accommodate for, I would think for an architect, you know, if you were just a visual artist and you were exploring things and trying to make a political statement or a social statement or a cultural statement, you could create something that was ugly if you chose to because you were trying to communicate that. I have to imagine as an architect, that's never an option for you to deliberately make something that's not beautiful.
That's actually a really complicated question. You know, I think beauty is actually a really complicated idea. I would have said what's taken place in the last couple decades is that we understand beauty as a cultural phenomena that is specific to a particular culture. So when we're living within a pluralistic place that we call the US of A, with this huge diversity of cultures that is literally global, one of the first questions would be under which orthodoxy of culture are we going to evaluate beauty as a particular idea? And I think what that's led to is actually demoting or de-emphasizing this preoccupation with beauty into something that's shifted to maybe, let's say, something that's compelling. So that you can look at buildings and you could look at our work, and would everybody find our work beautiful? I would think not. Impossible. How could that be? Some of them are shiny metal perforated buildings that you've never seen before. Well, that's not another discussion. You find things beautiful that you know, and things you don't know, you're curious about, and they might not fall under the beauty term yet. That might take 10 years from now after you've absorbed it, or you might choose otherwise.
So there's that rite of spring phenomenon where people freak out when they first see it.
Pompidou is the greatest example in Paris. Mm-hmm. You know, that it ran up, yeah. And the prisoners hated it, right? And there was one article after the other saying it was the most hideous thing and it was going to destroy Paris. And strangely enough, the articles were incredibly parallel to what happened with the Eiffel Tower 100 years earlier. And, of course, now Pompidou is one of the symbols of Paris. And the difference is, what was it, 3 years later, 4 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, people somehow grew to understand it within social cultural terms, understand it within an institution, go to decide buildings that look like boats are okay or what they like the colors. I have no idea, right? But there was also a shift where all of a sudden now you ask an average Parisian, they go, oh, of course, it's a major part of Paris, right? So there's that part of it that you grow to you're maybe suspicious of something you haven't seen, and it grows over time. And of course, architecture, different than most of the arts, is a quite complicated art form, which has many dimensions. It's seen over different seasons, seen in different light conditions, seen under different social conditions, seen under different use conditions, and all of those things participate with a longer period of time to digest or to understand this thing that you're looking at and deciding whether you like or not, and just putting in those very simple terms.
Do you think differently about a building like a place like the Museum of Nature and Science that many people will come to once a year or once in a lifetime or once every 5 years, as opposed to something like a courthouse where there are going to be thousands of people that walk in there every single day clutching a brown bag lunch, and this is sort of the space that they have to feel comfortable in on a regular basis?
Of course, this is a building that's going to get a return, definitely a repeat.
Yes, I'm sure people will be there every month, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's a special occasion place for most people.
Well, I think it's going to be both. I would think actually the discussions we're having is that it's not a special occasion place. It's actually a scene is absolutely integrated to your kind of sense of the city and as an extension of your educational environment. And there's a huge amount of discussion going on in both programming and architecture and the relationship of the two of, in fact, how the institution becomes absolutely connected. I'm not sure a day to day, but certainly within a yearly kind of cycle, as a part of an experience which expands you within the terms of that they're talking about, and the other customer you're talking about, the people that are visiting as a unique experience. That's interesting. We've really never had that direct conversation about it, but I suspect actually it's the first one that's more important.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a facility unlike, an opera hall. I'm trying to think of your other facilities here, music halls. Most of them do have two different types of groups. There's one that's going to be their regular, right? That's part of classical music or opera or whatever the venue is going to be something that's part of their daily lives, and I guess there's going to be the visitors, the tourists or whatever. But I think this facility. I think I can speak for the organization that I think the interest is something that's much more integrated and part of day-to-day life. And that's really, I think, something that would have to be very, very important so that the building can't just operate under shock and awe. It can't be a one-minute awe thing, right? Mm-hmm. It has to have, it has to have some sort of depth and it has to have some durability. That in fact, on your 20th or 30th visit, it still works.
Mm-hmm. Tom Main is my guest. He's the Pritzker Prize-winning architect who has been chosen to design the Museum of Nature and Science in Victory Park in Dallas. He'll be speaking tonight at a Nasher Salon Series event. You can join the conversation after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Tom Main is with us. He is going to be designing the Museum of Nature and Science in Victory Park in Dallas. He's in town to speak at a National Salon Series event tonight. If you'd like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. You said that you would start the Nature and Science project without any preconceived notions of what it ought to be. That seems like a nearly impossible task, to purge from your mind everything you know about facilities like this.
Huh. you're right. It is impossible. But I meant, maybe in a more literal sense. No, absolutely. When our design team came here, we come with an really very little baggage. And again, I've learned over the years that the preconception isn't really going to allow you to develop something which is fresh and new and specific. And I have been fascinated in my work not in developing a language of architecture which repeats itself, but to find that which is specific to its place, to its program, to the community, which develops something that's unique for that situation. And it's the generative material that allows the work to be to new and fresh in my mind, and it keeps reinvigorating the work. And of course, you have methods of working and drawing and interest in certain types of materials and methods of organization and things that represent continuities. But in terms of the particular project, I had absolutely not an idea until I was listening to my client group. And I look at the site and explore its context in Victory Park and look at the existing museum, et cetera, et cetera. And out of that comes something. Okay, so now you're going to see something where nature and building come together, and that's something I've been interested in for 20 years. And you're going to see a building that's partly pushed in the ground and becomes seen maybe more as landscape than a traditional building, and you're going to see a building that connects to that, and the building makes reference to landscape. And I'm interested in an idea of new a type of architecture which explores a middle ground between what we think of as landscape and building, and that talks about a new thinking that's parallel to the way we talk about biology and ecology, et cetera. And that you're going to see there's 20 years of work that represents buildings that begin that trajectory. And there are those things that are existing. But the building itself is starts with the first conversations. The actual specific thing, right? And actually, we force ourselves. No sketches, no drawings, no a priori work. You wait and you start working when it's appropriate that you have the first initial information, instincts, hunches that come from these discussions.
So how does that team function? You're the lead guy on these projects, but what do you sort of leave to other people who work with you, and how does that work?
Oh, I leave a lot. I'm called Morphosis, and it started in 1972. And it was a kind of very 60s idea, I guess, but it was an idea about a collective practice. I was looking at film a lot, and I saw architecture very parallel to film in its collaborative nature. And it was very conscious of removing authorship in a singular way, Tom Main, out of the firm and putting a name. It happens to be the Morphosis is very generic, the development of form. It applies to architecture and to planning and to landscape and to industrial design, et cetera. And we very much work like that. I guess my position very simply would be that of the auteur, the director, and then I'm definitely guiding conceptually the interests, et cetera, of the group. But it's a just the way you're asking about preconceived ideas. There's discussions, and sometimes I'm putting down the first kind of hunch, and it's in somewhat a form already. It's formed as that something's closer to architecture. And other times it's just ideas. It'll be about the land, or it's about a slope, or it's about a force of movement, or it's about something. There'll be just words. And then we start working back and forth. And it's a collective practice. I think most, if you asked other people in my profession, they would see our practice as being very clearly a very particular type of practice, which is represents where I'm the leadership, and I'm part of the directorship, but it's absolutely collaborative. And then, of course, with that comes the huge numbers of people that work on large-scale projects, the structural engineers and the mechanical engineers and the landscape architects and the cost estimators, on and on. I left a meeting today on the same project, and there were 20 of us at the table, and we were in the very beginning of the project just introducing the basic components of getting a pre-schematic, the beginning kind of essence of what a project is going to be going. And I love that.
I was going to ask if you enjoy that part of it.
I love working with a lot of people. Yeah. A lot of people think of the Ayn Rand, Frank Lloyd Wright idea of an architect. Actually,
alone
that comes up with a lot of your questions. You enter the room, everything's in your brain, wherever it's located, and you have this incredible kind of creative instinct, and you already have this kind of genius idea in your head, and you're going to lay it down and show it to somebody. And for me, completely the opposite. Kind of walk in the room, absolutely kind of black, nothing up there. You start discussion, and to put me in a room by myself with my equipment, I'd go nutty. I wouldn't develop anything. I need interaction. I need pushback. I need the kind of dynamicism of kind of the group activity for to develop the creative act. And even more than that, more than one project. I need minimum of 3 or 4 projects to work at simultaneously.
So you don't want your vision
focused.
Find
a relationship between projects that you'll be working on this desk on one project and it seems to be about something, and all of a sudden you find out the discussion is important to somebody else over here doing another project, and it just is this cross-fertilization. And it's like it's like the synaptic kind of activity in your brain, I think, left, right, that takes place and kind of how we think. But it's seen as a collective activity.
Tom Main is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak to Jerry in Denton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi,
Mr. Main, this is very interesting. I kind of got into the car about 15 minutes ago and just heard you say that why should we make things from the past when all this wonderful stuff exists in the present? And, you know, I like modern architecture, but the idea that something comes out of nothing or comes out of its moment it doesn't really work. It doesn't really happen. Everything comes from something. And architecture that really was so minimal that it seemed divorced to me is kind of a dead end, a cul-de-sac, and a very limited aesthetic value, and in many cases really horrible. It seems to me that a kind of a postmodern ethic works better where there's an awareness and respect paid to what went before, and sometimes references to it. You know, I think while I've been driving, I think your destination tonight at the Nasher, you know, I've read Renzo Piano's feelings about that building, about that design. He likened it to coming across a ruin, a precinct in a grove, a sacred with remnants of walls, which are kind of carried out by that trope of a museum without a ceiling. As though it's the walls remaining, and there are these wonderful artifacts scattered around and carried out again by the material of the walls, that kind of bleached marble look. And all those things kind of sometimes, I guess, in just subtle ways, refer back to the past.
Jerry, I think...
And make it more valuable. I wonder what you say to that.
Thanks for your call, Jerry. Did you want to respond?
Early part of the question, or the last part, the first part on history. I guess it's hard for me to understand this huge over abundance or over the huge energy put to the past when we live in an era with so many opportunities and potentials in our work. And whether it's technological, whether it has to do with the shifts in artistic kind of ideas of what buildings are, whether it has to do with buildings within an urban setting, that I just don't understand the overinvestment in history. And then, of course, with that, if you look at what you were saying are postmodern buildings, which, by the way, are very particular to this country. You'll find no interest in Europe where they have, quote, real history. That if you look at these buildings, it would be really hard, if you're interested in history, to admire them. They're made out of stucco and drivet and modern materials, which were the most pastiche copies of the originals. And if you're interested in a brick building, you'd be interested in the way they point brick and the whole notion of the reality of brick, as in the essence of brick as a material, which is fascinating. It doesn't happen anymore. We don't have masons that can even make and produce buildings out of brick. We're looking 100 years ago before we could find that. And I don't know. It's a tough question. I have to say that for me, the one that's most interesting, if you actually go to places that have history, and I'm talking about Western history, that our connection through Europe, let's say, there is absolutely no interest in this whatsoever. They're interested in modern architecture, and you're going to be startled by the opportunities you're going to see, the potentials that exist today.
I want to talk for a minute about sustainability. You've done a lot of really innovative things to make buildings that are energy efficient and sort of live in the space that they exist. But you've criticized the LEED system as being kind of a checklist that allows people to sort of say they've done it and not necessarily have maximized sustainability.
Boy, that's really gotten around. It's
you just say one thing to the New York Times.
It's over with. Look, I completely admire what LEED has done. And they are now the kind of singular authority that has ramped up our notion of buildings that operate at a higher performance and that deal with energy in serious ways. The comment was meant to discuss that it's based on performance, which is somewhat prescriptive. And in our work, in this case, we're talking about San Francisco, as we started looking at the realities of producing a building, which radically shifted our use of petroleum products in terms of heating and cooling, we realized that it was the shape of the building, and it was really a much more elemental idea of what architecture is in terms of how you shape space, in this case, a tall building that's only 55 feet wide, that was really the major kind of issue, and we brought that from Europe. Because as you know, Europeans in general use one half the energy per capita of the U.S., right? And architecture contributes, I think, something like 40% of that. Well, in a narrow building, you get all natural light, and you can be in this building and in the middle of the day on a cloudy day, and you need no light at all for incident light. We get natural ventilation coming through for the upper, as you said, the top floors after the sixth floor. And none of that's included in LEED. It's a point system. And so I'm saying that because our most successful building, we have other buildings that have gotten gold. We have a whole series of them that got gold. The most successful one by far was the San Francisco. They didn't even get a rating. And so all I was saying is there's just different courses to the same problem. There's different methods of achieving that. And in the San Francisco, we looked at first principles and we looked at kind of major ideas. And what we're looking at is actually the proof of the building in terms of its delta in terms of energy, period. Right, and in the LEED program, it's much more complicated. And there's a list of items which you have to operate in terms of performance that gives you your rating system. I think in the next generation of LEEDs, I can already anticipate. I've been in discussions with Rick Fajazi, the head of it. That it's, I think, if I remember right, it's 9 years old. The program, it's a very new program, and I suspect they themselves, from what I understand, are looking at evolving. That comes directly from their success. Right, that they, I think, even could have anticipated the degree of success they would have had in such a short period of time, which is, by the way, moving from the smaller structures, the residential structures and smaller commercial structures, which I think, if I remember right, it was really set up to solve. They weren't really thinking of large-scale projects, and it's now ramped up to large-scale urban projects. And great sign, good sign. And I guess I'm kind of challenging the box. I'm looking at the problem from fresh viewpoint. And this notion that you brought up about the challenging LEEDs wasn't as much challenging LEEDs as just looking at different ways of solving the same problem.
So in other words, we can do that and other things as well.
Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Pritzker Prize-winning architect Tom Main, who will design the Museum of Nature and Science in Victory Park in Dallas. Let's speak next to Charles in Dallas. Hello, Charles.
Hi. I have a question. I was thinking about... his comment about landscape and the building blending in together. And I was wondering about the green roof movement. which seems to be more common on the east or west coast. Does he know if that's catching on more, and would he use something like that in this part of the country? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Yes, it's what's funny, it's not just the energy. To put a green roof in a building isn't necessarily energy efficient. It depends on the condition that you're building in, the location. Interestingly enough, the project we're working on is going to be – this will be part of it. That will be part of the building that is, in fact, landscape in the roof. And there are two things. One, is it in fact useful in real terms, in terms of energy saving, because you're looking at its use in terms of an insulative factor of temperature from outside to inside. But the one I think that I'm most interested in is the relationship in didactic sense. It's one that communicates very clearly our relationship with the ground, the earth, the planet, et cetera. And in our, let's say, our project in NOAA, we put 5 acres of space underground and a huge mound, like a stupa, like an Indian mound. And the idea was, as they look at themselves in their own satellites from 100 miles up, that the site's empty. There's one bar that has the dishes on it. And that because they see themselves as the caretakers of the world. And so the idea was really as much to do with the symbol of the act as it was the reality. And it's going to always be a much more complicated kind of issue between the actual solving of energy and the way you want to communicate that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Actually, we need to take a break now, so we'll have more in just a minute. Tom Main is my guest. He is the Pritzker Prize-winning architect who will design the Museum of Nature and Science. He is speaking this evening in Dallas at a Nasher Salon Series event. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with architect Tom Main. He will appear tonight at a Nasher Salon Series event. You can find information about that on our website or at nashersalonseries.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Have your considerations for safety changed since 9/11?
Security?
Security. Yeah.
They have. And they've... No, they've really ramped up. If you really look closely at all of our recent buildings, you're going to find kind of objects in courtyards. And we've spent a huge amount of time making them somehow into architecture that aren't seen as security, their primary person's security. But anyway, there was a conference in Washington 3 years ago that Moynihan spoke just before he died, and it was really, really amazing. And he was discussing this idea of security in federal buildings. And his notion was that we should make our buildings more transparent and more open, representing our system of democracy, and should not cave in to this to these forces. And at the same time, to do what's necessary to make them, in real terms, secure. And I was just so taken by that to build barriers, to start building out of concrete, to start having buildings look opaque and protected, couldn't be a more horrible idea in terms of representing our response to this global situation, however you want to talk about it. Again, that's a complicated subject. And so all of our work has been kind of working with this idea of trying to increase transparency while at the same time to deal with the realities of security, most of which is keeping vehicles at distances from the building, et cetera, et cetera. And you'll see literally in all the work, it's disguised as furniture, landscape, urban devices, part of an urban hardscape landscape.
I know that you have put open stairways in a lot of your buildings to get people walking around instead of taking the elevators. When did that start to be something that you thought, this is a change that I can make that can affect the way people live?
Well, it's known to all architects because of Corbusier with the skip stop. Mm-hmm. A skip stop, I have always had to tell people, is you come up every three floors and walk up, walk down.
Right.
Right? And so it's been around. Everybody knows about it. We became fascinated with a series of public projects. You're right. In San Francisco, I could rattle through the Caltrans, our building in New York, Cooper. It makes sense economically. It's the most interesting socially. It concentrates people. I'm fascinated with the intensification of people, how they use buildings, which represents how you use cities. And within those areas of intensification come communication, dialogue, the relationship between people bumping into each other. I live in New York, and I like New York because you literally are bumping into people all day, and it's and they're from all over the world, and it keeps you awake and alive, and it's immensely stimulating. And this idea of communicating with producing intensification became very much part of it, and as a social model. And it seems with all of our public work, we've been exploring with different types of movement systems which have to do with this idea.
You still live in 1,400 square feet?
I still live in 1,600 square feet. I do. Mm-hmm. In fact, my kids are one of them just turned 21 and the other is 24. And so we have it to ourselves now.
So
we're through the crowded. We talk about intensification. We're through the crowded phase already.
So, you know, people would assume.
Well, how did you know we live in 1,400 square feet?
Oh,
where does this stuff
somewhere.
Come from? Anyway?
I do research like crazy. but people would assume that you would have this palatial estate somewhere. Can you talk about your relationship to your own space?
Huh. It was intentional. It's actually 1,600 square feet. Mm-hmm. It was a little 30s cottage on a hill in Ocean Park by Venice, California. And I don't know how to answer that. I've lived a kind of an academic life most of my life, and a fairly simple life. I mean, it's not complicated. And it's a neighborhood I respected. It's a place I've lived for quite a while. And if you know LA at all, that Venice Ocean Park is its own little town, and there've always been a lot of artists, academics. It's its own. It's kind of creative community, let's say. It happens to be on the beach and a very, very beautiful community. And I'm not trying to answer that. It just seemed the thing to do. My kids went to public school. I mean, we belong to a community, and it's definitely a political act that we're I mean, education is the glue of this culture, and public education is, I think, the most important issue on the table today, absolutely without any question whatsoever, if we're going to maintain our status intellectually as a creative culture. And I wanted to support that. And Santa Monica is a place that is known for its schools, and we moved there when we had children, and so the house became part of that. And then, of course, my house is a family project. It's always tinkered with. My wife is from Italian background, and we've treated our house like Italians. Bit at a time. You never changed anything. You just keep changing little pieces, and mm-hmm. we've done it for literally 17 years. A wall changes, and you add another little piece here, and it's just always something going on. And it becomes it's part of a creative lifestyle for a family that all of us participate. The stuff in it are, if it's art, it's friends we know, and it's things we traded, it's our own stuff, and our stuff we've produced on our trips, et cetera. And then you just grow to love it. And I guess in that way, we're very old-fashioned and very traditional, that it becomes your place. And it's not about upgrading to something bigger and fancier in a better neighborhood. It's just the opposite. It's like the more you work on it, the more it becomes you, you meaning your family, and it becomes more and more personalized, and it's indistinguishable from your family. It is your family. So when you walk in it, everything you're looking at is some sort of a product of 17, in my case, 17, 20 years, whatever it's been, of living there. And it's it gets where it's going to be hard to part from it. It's not – because that's a whole other thing. Why do people keep wanting bigger things?
Well, I was gonna
you
say,
want things that are more personal, that have qualities. Bigness has nothing to do with anything. It's just you want – it's about value and it's about quality. And the big thing is, come on, that's early 20th century and 19th and 18th. That's an American thing. Young country, endless space, and big is better. That's been over with for decades. Don't you think?
But I have to imagine that you have clients all the time who don't share those values with you, who want bigger, better, faster, more.
Well, but... Maybe, but that's going to have to do with the dialogue. I remember one of the first houses we did. It was a couple that was building this enormous house, and I was begging them to build a very small little pavilion like the Philip Johnson Estate in New Canaan. And we built this larger house, and I was teasing with them because they were a couple. But it was their life dream in a way. And then years later, we agreed that probably they could have built a guest house and had this huge piece of land, this beautiful piece of land, and really had a garden. And it literally was a Blenheim Palace or something, this immense garden. It was just fabulous. Look, everybody's going to come to their own conclusion on this, but I suspect that it has to do with a cultural phenomenon. As we get older, it has to be moving, I think, towards qualities and not scale. But I'd say that's happening today. Certainly, the I'm looking even in this city is people. I was shocked by the amount of urbanism in this town. Mm-hmm. A lot of people live downtown.
It's getting very dense now. It's
more
been
so
last
more,
decade.
More so than LA, I have to say, downtown LA. And I would have said it has to be a discussion taking place in Dallas. That as you move downtown, you move in an apartment, you live in an urban scale life, you completely reassess the nature of what that means and the nature of the spaces you live in and what that means to your own lifestyle. And certainly, one of them is it's less. But it probably is also increasing, certainly in particular qualities, including being able to walk to a cafe, including to walk the huge numbers of cultural activities, et cetera, that are now available to you instantly, right? Meaning that you're going to use them more, that they're going to become part of your life. And it goes back to the discussion we were having about the Nature and Science Museum versus an event of going to the theater, an event of going to see to a museum or to see dance or whatever. It becomes absolutely integrated to your life.
It's in the neighborhood. You sort of roll out the door and you're there.
It's like living in New York. You have all the stuff available to you, and because it's available to you, you use it. Mm-hmm. And then because you use it, it increases the cycle, and more people move downtown and more events take place downtown. There's more cafes and on. And pretty soon you have a real city.
We're working on that. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Julio in Dallas. Hi, Julio.
Hi,
go ahead.
Yes, my question is, young children will experience this facility and be impacted by it. I wonder if the architect would talk to how he would address the child's perspective as well as the adult's perspective, and I'll hang up on the radio.
Thanks for your call.
Terrific. That's a great question. You know, I realized 10 or 12 years ago that kids under, I'm trying to think of the age, would be about 11 or 12, are my best customers. They really understand architecture at a different level. Why? I think within our culture, as people get older, they have they somehow develop ideas what architecture is or isn't. And maybe it shifts from values or enhancement to status, the discussion we were having earlier. Mm-hmm. And the status means a building looks like this or that. And it doesn't really have to do with its essence. A child looks at something and just sees it for what it is. And it's not encumbered by the cultural baggage that comes with society that, say, to an earlier questioner, says that buildings should look like old buildings. And so all of a sudden, by the time you're 17 or the time you're 20, you're expecting buildings to look like buildings in the 19th century in some place in Europe or whatever you think they're coming from. And it's funny, we had a great example of this. We were working on the Diamond Ranch High School 10 years ago, and I remember the faculty going, I think you're shooting over their heads. And then later we were talking to the superintendent of schools, who was just this amazing character, who had huge optimism about his young students and said, no, no, no. In my opinion, this is over dinner, you're over the heads with the teachers. The students are – this is a high school. The students are fine. And sure enough, when we built the building, the young people – and this is kind of a very modern building. It looks more like a stealth fighter than it does a normal building. The kids immediately got it. What does it mean by getting it to begin with? It seemed contemporary to them. It just seemed okay.
They walked in and were comfortable
in the
space.
And it seemed normal. Yeah. And it just seemed like it belonged to their culture. And that's finally, we were discussing about beauty. That's really what it is. It's not about beauty or what it looks like. It just you sense you're living in the time that you exist and that represents the potentialities and the realities of who we are. And kids are great at that. They're the best.
Do you ever fantasize about seeing all of your buildings in the same city or in the same place?
Not even possible. In fact, I wish I could do – well, that's not true then. I wish I did have more work in one particular place. Today, architects just work all over the globe, and we're just spread all over the place, meaning no, it's the opposite. Just not possible.
It's not possible, but would you like to see what they'd all look like sort of lined up together? And I know they function differently according to the space and all that.
No, they're all – they're a huge amount of work is from the outside in. They really are about responding to a site, and some of them more than others. And if you look at our building, the Far Tower in Paris, it's literally a representative of the forces on the site literally make the building. There's a big hole that comes through it, which is part of an alley to a campus. And there's a piece that comes out of a rail station below, and there's another one that comes out of a freeway piece below. And there's the lobby ends up being 110 feet in the air because of the circumstance, and you have an escalator that takes you way up and you get a view of the city before you even get to the elevator from the rapid transit, and it goes on and on. And it couldn't be anyplace else. It's designed just for this one place.
And that's the second tallest building besides the Eiffel Tower.
It is.
Is that right? Have you gotten over being daunted by things like that when you start a big project? Now that you're Tom Main, Pritzker Prize winner, and you've been doing this for decades, is there still a little part of you that thinks, wow?
Oh, of course. Are you kidding me? Oh, absolutely. It's just no, I want to take my kids there. Your dad did this. Absolutely. I think all of us. If my office is listening, oh my God, because I'm the most critical of the group. But no, we're doing an astrophysics lab at Caltech, and I went Saturday morning to look at some things, to solve some, look at some problems. And no, I came away, and I don't try to, I'm pretty tough on myself. That's our job, to be critics. And I was just kind of blown away by it. And I left in the car on the way. I had a half an hour drive on the way home to my next meeting. And I'm going and kind of patting myself on the back or patting my team in the back and going, wow, this is a great space we did here. No, of course. Being an architect is like being a kid. You get to think up stuff and then make it and look at it. Right?
It's cool.
It's fabulous.
Tom Main, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You can see Tom tonight at a Nasher Salon Series event. You can learn about that on our website. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.